Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings, you're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. I always worry I'm going to say that wrong. There's just because you say the same word so many times. Anyway, my guest is Jacob Hubert. Jacob Hubert is an associated scholar at the Mises Institute. He's the former president of the Liberty Justice Center, and he's currently the senior litigation counsel for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. And you'd think with all that we'd be talking a lot about what's going on in the justice system, and that actually would be a great conversation to have at a later date. But maybe talk to me a little bit before we get into the real topic here today about what you're doing at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, because that sounds interesting.
Yeah, so I'm a senior attorney at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which is a nonprofit public interest law firm that brings lawsuits especially to push back against the administrative state, against the part of the government, especially the federal government, that makes rules that govern everybody's lives, even though they're not elected people, and under the Constitution, they're not supposed to be making the rules. And our view is that by enforcing the Constitution's separation of powers, we can strengthen the Constitution's defense for liberty. The separation of powers is a defense for liberty. And if you keep the different branches in their lanes, as the Constitution says, the government would be a lot more restrained as a result. And in fact, NCLA, before I worked there, was responsible for the Supreme Court case that overturned the Chevron doctrine, which you might have heard of, where courts would accept federal regulation, federal agencies' interpretations of their own regulations in lots of cases, instead of just doing what they're supposed to do and decide for themselves what the law means. And as a result of that, agencies should be a lot more constrained in what they can do. So that's the sort of thing that we do at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Now, talking to you here today, of course, I'm just speaking for myself, not on behalf of NCLA, but I am very proud of what we do at NCLA, and I do think it helps to advance liberty.
Well, and I've talked to folks before from, FIRE, a Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and also Institute for Justice, and there seems like there might be some overlap in what you guys are doing, but also you guys have kind of a more of a niche, it sounds like, related to administrative state overreach specifically?
Yeah, definitely very familiar and friendly with those groups, but we are focused especially on the administrative state, and that overlaps in some cases with constitutional rights, where the administrative state is violating people's constitutional rights. But yeah, we do have that more specific focus at NCLA.
Cool. Well, I'd love to have you or at least somebody back from the NCLA to talk about some of the work you guys are doing, because that also sounds like it'd be really cool to talk about for an hour. Well, so the reason I do have you here, at least for today, is I found an old presentation you did at the Mises Circle in Chicago in April 2011. And the presentation was called, Is There Hope for Liberty in Our Lifetime? And one thing that stuck out to me, I had to check the date on it. There was a reference to the Tea Party and kind of who their heroes were, who they were sort of congregating around, who they were listening to. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later, but you mentioned in 2011, you said, well, maybe Donald Trump is sort of a rising influencer within that movement. And I thought 2011, you were saying that. So yeah, but I'm
was
sure.
A joke. There was a poll of who do the Tea Party people like as their presidential candidate. And there was three people, none of whom are who you would think of as particularly liberty-loving people. And Donald Trump had just at that time announced that he was thinking about running or going to run, whatever it was, fizzled out very quickly. And so I threw that as a joke. Well, maybe now they'll put Donald Trump on the top of their list. And it got a big laugh from the room because that was presumed to be absurd. But here we are.
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to go too far on that rabbit trail, but there's, as much as I'm sensitive and agree with a lot of the sort of the critique of the, kind of the intelligentsia and the mainstream media and all that, it was hard for me to fault them for not taking Donald Trump seriously, because the story of, Donald Trump announcing his candidacy, I just think didn't look like a serious story. Like, of course, they kind of thought of it as a joke. It would be like if Jim Carrey was running for president, or, you know, a dog in a tutu that could stand on two legs was running for president. Like, it just sounded like such a silly idea that, like, you know, I think a lot of people were offended, you know, in the MAGA world that it wasn't taken seriously. And obviously he won, but I understood why at the time it seemed like such a silly thing to say. Well, so the presentation was, is there hope for liberty in our lifetime? And so before we get into some of the positive aspects, the you know, maybe yes answers to that question, I want to talk about the sort of the negative case, the reasons that you established for why we maybe should be pessimistic, or at least why some of the things that we were using, the means that we were trying to get to liberty, might not be as effective as we'd hope they would be. And so this presentation was about 15 years ago. And at the time, a lot of people, I think, were feeling optimistic about a libertarian future in the light of the, you know, the Ron Paul revolution and the even bigger Tea Party movement. And you were not so sanguine at the time about, we'll start with the Tea Party. And so why was that? And do you think the Tea Party ended up being a force for liberty in retrospect? Was your pessimism undue at the time, or was it completely appropriate?
Oh, it was appropriate. The Tea Party was the supposed, you know, backlash against the federal government, federal overreach, taxes from the federal government. That's sort of what it portrayed itself as, and media treated it as. But, you know, I looked at the time at, well, what do Tea Partiers actually believe? Or what do they think when you poll them on the issues? Who are their political heroes? Who would they like to see as president? And when you looked at those things, they did not align at all with the libertarian movement. They, you know, the political figures they were revered were just kind of the standard Republican political figures at the time, you know, ones who maybe sprinkled in a little more rhetoric about liberty, but this was nothing radical. If they got who they wanted in office, you could know that they're not going to have significant change from that. There was a poll at the time that said 47% of Tea Partiers report that they're angry with the federal government. Well, that's less than half. So I guess that this couldn't be too much of an anti-federal power movement if less than half of them are even angry with the federal government, let alone motivated to do anything about it. And then, of course, political movements like this, even if some of their origins are good in arising out of people actually being fed up with the federal government and the things that it does, well, then people, of course, latch on to these political movements and exploit them for political purposes. And I think there was a lot of that going on, too, where you had more mainstream political people, political grifter types latch on to this, see it as the big thing of the moment, and then it's never very effective. Now, there could be some good things that came of it. As I recall, Rand Paul came to the Senate on that Tea Party wave, and some other people who were better than average did. And that may be good as far as it goes, but has the federal government changed course as a result of that? Are we significantly freer as a result of that? Well, not perceptibly, and certainly it didn't affect any radical change in the way our government works or the way it infringes on.
Yeah, well, and you know, to some extent, maybe it anticipated the MAGA revolution in that it was this kind of unfocused populist rage without any kind of a clear sense of like what kind of society we should be building. Well, so much for the grassroots electoral politics, right? So at the time, you were pessimistic about electoral politics making a freer society, and you know, certainly the Libertarian Party has not emerged as a major force in the intervening 15 years. There was that kind of Liberty Caucus of the Republican Party that came out of the Tea Party movement. But, you know, in the previous election, just to kind of get back to the Libertarian Party, the party basically kind of threw the election for Trump. And the LP chair at the time argued that this was basically the future role of the Libertarian Party if we want to make a difference. So whether it's Libertarian or Republican or even Democratic party politics, have you gotten any more positive about what electoral politics might be able to do since 2011, or would you say you're more pessimistic or about the same?
No, I've become more convinced that electoral politics poisons everything and makes people worse than they otherwise would be. I think we have good evidence for that now. You know, there was a little bit of a temptation to be optimistic in that direction when Javier Milei was elected president of Argentina on extremely libertarian rhetoric. and started enacting some very good libertarian reforms, although not across the board. And then with Trump coming back in 2024, although there were always lots of reasons to be skeptical of Trump, well, you did have Elon Musk talking about Doge and everything they were going to do with that. I was very, very skeptical that Doge could accomplish anything, and it was proven right in my skepticism. But, you know, there was a little bit like, oh, maybe things could, you know, turn back a little bit. But of course, that hasn't happened at all. Everything, or most everything, has gotten worse with respect to what the federal government is doing to the people. And but really, that's to be expected. The worst part is you did see liberty-loving people buying into this, thinking, well, this is what we need to do. The left, the Democrats, they're such a huge threat to our liberty right now that we need to fight them by whatever means are available, and Donald Trump will fight them for us. So he may go and do some things we don't like, but they're just such an existential threat. We need to back this guy, and this is the only way that we're going to change things in the country. And it's a little bit understandable why people might think that, especially under Biden with all the censorship of social media that went on. I could see how you sort of panic over that, because if they succeeded in that and it could keep doing that, well, that would make things like abnormally worse if we were in a perpetual regime of censorship of ideas like we had for a while under Biden. So that's a little bit understandable. But that doesn't mean you run to the other guy. Of course, that's how they always do it, right? The one side scares you and you run to the other one. And then you don't like them and you run back. And we just go back and forth between these two sides that only increase the size of government. And it gets worse. And unfortunately, I think it's a very bad trend that this kicked off among libertarians. And I'm not criticizing anybody in particular, but I just see this generally. People, once they've decided, okay, there's the team of good guys and bad guys, and I've cast my lot with these people who I've, for some reason, not really good guys, I'm going to stick with that. I'm going to rationalize the things they do that are bad, that I always would have said were bad, and because I think, well, we need to win this war for the greater good. But as we see this play out, we see that the current administration is not working for the greater good, that things seem to be going the way they always go, which is for more statism. There are little things here and there we could celebrate. But yeah, it's really disturbing to see people put their faith in electoral politics like that and sacrifice their principles to attempt to achieve things in politics.
Yeah, well, and you know, you talk about the kind of the duality of the good side and the bad side. I think there's a lot of people, libertarians, Republicans, whatever, who sort of said, well, I know Trump isn't good, but he's the lesser of two evils. But over time, like that's hard to sustain. I voted for somebody who's really not good, like, but they're a little better than the other side. Like, I think there's always a temptation to rationalize it, as you mentioned, and before long, you're down for whatever they're doing. So, I mean, in regard to the electoral politics thing, you'd said at the time, in your sort of pessimism about electoral politics doing much good, there's only one Ron Paul. And I mean, but you know, we've got Thomas Massie now. You mentioned Javier Milei. Do those give us any reasons for thinking that there could be, or is it just kind of the whole Albert J. Nock, Isaiah's Job thing, just the voice crying in the wilderness, you know, being ignored and sort of representing the remnant and testifying? I mean, is that all that a Thomas Massie can really be?
Yeah, the point about the Ron Paul comment was, well, yes, you had him elected to a pretty high office. And maybe that would make some people think, well, we just need to elect more Ron Pauls. But there aren't enough people like that who would stay totally principled and vote their principles regardless of the political consequences all the time. And all the time adhering to and espousing a real libertarian message. There just aren't people getting into electoral politics who are like that generally, because that's not why you get into electoral politics. And it's not, and you know, it's not necessarily in most places and times a recipe for political success. So, you know, it's nice that he was there, but the value of Ron Paul's holding the office that he did was simply because that gave him a platform to say the message where receptive people might hear it and then go study the ideas underlying it, go study Mises at Rothbard and that sort of thing. And many, many people did as a result. What he did was very beneficial in that respect. At the same time, it may have given some people a taste for politics where they go on this wrong track where they say, okay, well, Ron Paul didn't work out, but who can be elect? And well, Donald Trump is saying some things that sound a little bit like what Ron Paul said. So let's go do that because I want to get something done in politics now. And once people start thinking in terms of electoral politics, they're thinking about the short-term wins and not so much about adhering to principle at all costs. You mentioned Thomas Massie. I think he's really great. But similar to Ron Paul in that his own party doesn't really want to have anything to do with him right now. And he got asked to stand alone or with a few people in standing up to certain bad things. And it's great that he's there doing that because people can see that he's doing it, hear him explain why he's doing it. And that may make, again, people go study the ideas more. It might have some electoral consequences if he remains in office and maybe there's somebody else who pops up and tries for it. But are we going to have a Congress full of Thomas Massies or even more than a few of them? Oh, almost certainly not.
Well, fair enough. Well, so, okay. We talked about grassroots, talked about electoral politics. Another focus of yours was the courts, that there are libertarians who thought, well, we can use the courts to expand freedom. And, you know, I would assume by your current position that maybe you do think that there's there's some room for that to happen. But you didn't have a lot of confidence in that approach then. But you've done some things since then that have availed some positive things. So are you less pessimistic about using the courts for liberty now? Or is it just kind of like one of those things where it's like, well, you got to have at least one Ron Paul, you got to have at least one Thomas Massie, but also kind of on the legal effort. It's like, we're not going to win this way, but we can have little wins and you got to do it. You got to fight the windmills because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I got into this line of work just a few months after I hit that speech. I wasn't totally down on it then. And I certainly am not now. I think that if you're going to work within the system, so to speak, the courts are a much better way to go than electoral politics because you can definitely have concrete wins that increase people's liberty. And the example I think I cited then and that I would still cite now that stands out for this is the Heller case from the Supreme Court, where they said the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms. And they followed that with another decision saying, and that protection applies against the states as well. That made a huge difference to the liberty of Americans. I mean, you had cities like New York and Chicago where people could not exercise their right to have a firearm for self-defense at all. And now they can. They try to put little obstacles in their way and make it hard. But basically, everywhere in this country now you can, where previously there was lots of places you couldn't. And so that just goes to show you, like, you can engage in legal activism and do a lot of good for a lot of people. The mistake would be to think that you can get the whole thing that way, to think that, well, just push and push and eventually we'll confine the government to the strict limits of the Constitution and it all will be good. Now, of course, even the Constitution by its terms isn't actually libertarian. It's a lot better than what we got, but it's not actually libertarian. And you're not going to maintain a relatively libertarian government unless the people want it. Because if the people are demanding more spending and stuff like that, the politicians are going to keep voting for it. And they're going to ensure that they have courts that allow it. And so unless you have, you know, a real change in people's views, a critical mass of people's views, then you're not going to get what you want through the government. I mean, you're not going to get what you want through government at all. But you know, the courts aren't going to come along and do something that is contrary to what all the politicians and most of the American people want. You get something like gun rights where, well, actually a critical mass of the American people do want Second Amendment rights, including people on the left and the right. And there are political reasons why they might not get it in certain places. But that's something where the Supreme Court can say that, and a lot of people will go along with it. And the fact that the Supreme Court said it actually makes more people recognize it as a right that they have, and that's very helpful. So there are discrete issues like that where I think legal activism could do a lot of good. But if you think all we got to do is get the courts to enforce the Constitution, well, that's not all you got to do, but it would help.
Well, and so far, it seems like the picture that you're presenting is that there's room for libertarians to be involved in electoral politics. There's room for libertarians to be involved in grassroots movements, to do things on the court level. But ultimately, that's part of a piecemeal approach that's about getting people to the basically critical mass of people to think differently, not to spoil the ending a little bit. But I think that's kind of where we're leading at this point, that this work can be helpful. It can actually could be very important, that we don't just want to let the world burn until where everybody suddenly wakes up and the country's destroyed and we're ready to try libertarianism. But so that effort is important, right? The using the courts to get those victories where we can get them.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the main core point of being a libertarian is just having an understanding about morality, and about whether what the government does is moral, or whether things become moral when the government does them, even if they wouldn't be moral or if you or I do them. And it's about having a proper understanding of economics and recognizing that government intervention in the economy is going to make things worse rather than better. It's fundamentally about just getting that understanding for yourself so that you're seeing the world more clearly. And we would like other people to think that way so that we can live freer. And there are ways to engage in activism and spread the message to make that more likely. But you can't see political change as the point of you being a libertarian. At least that's not how I see it. The point is to just have an accurate understanding of the world and be a moral person yourself. And if you can make the world more like you think it ought to be, that's great. But it's not the point. And if you start focusing on the politics, then in so many cases, the politics start coming first and you lose sight of why you were a libertarian in the first place.
Hey, everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's a really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
You know, one thing that stuck out to me about that 2011 speech is how much ire you had for the right, which seems appropriate to me because, you know, as libertarians, we're not supposed to really like either side. But Trump drew a lot of our previously stalwart liberty advocates into MAGA, including, you know, some folks who had some affiliation with the Mises Institute. So I guess my question is, you know, what do you make of that? Do you think support for Trump was an example of what some would call high time preference, leading libertarians to take statist shortcuts?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. People, they want to see a move toward liberty in their lifetime. They want to see political change, and they get impatient. So when they think a candidate is going to move us in that direction, they may jump on that. And, you know, you could see why people would think Trump might be good for that. And when he started out, even though he advocated many unlibertarian positions from the very beginning, you could still see, well, you know, he's criticizing the wars, he's criticizing the mainstream media and a number of things that libertarians think should be criticized that ordinarily aren't talked about. And so I can certainly see why that was interesting to people and why you might be tempted to buy it, or why you might very reasonably have thought, whether you were involved in politics yourself or not, that Trump would be preferable to the Democrat alternatives. So, you know, it's understandable. I mean, it happens, right, with other Republican presidents. I think that there's, you know, sort of libertarians who lean right when they, will jump on the bandwagon when there's a Republican president or presidential candidate who says the right things that gets their attention and has them jump on board. Happened with George W. Bush as well. So Trump isn't unique in that respect, though he certainly is unique in other respects, including his appeal to a certain segment of the libertarian population that otherwise might not be involved in politics at all.
Well, you know, but building on that, there is a quick reference in that speech about tendencies on the right to a form of collectivist thinking that's kind of more bigoted. I think Ayn Rand either said something like that, that racism was kind of the ultimate form of collectivism. And, you know, I've argued, you know, with some of my libertarian right friends that in a libertarian society, people can have, you know, racist ideas so long as they're inconsistent enough about them to treat their neighbors as equals anyway. But what I don't think is true is that a racist person can be ideologically libertarian, because libertarianism seems to me to be built on this foundation that every individual has the same rights due to our shared humanity. And so, you know, you can be a racist in a libertarian society, but you can't be a racist libertarian. And so I'd be curious, because it's something that you brought up in that speech, that kind of collectivized bigoted thinking, what your take on, libertarian, I guess, kind of toleration of those views within the fold, or should we be, should we not be?
So if I can completely agree that someone could not be ideological libertarian and hold certain racist views, it kind of depends on how you define libertarian and how you define racist. If you're, you know, if your definition of libertarianism is simply boils down to the non-aggression principle, and you can't use force against people, peaceful people, well, you could hold that view, and you could also hold odious views about other races and not aggress against, you could do that, but it's certainly incongruous, and it's unlikely that somebody would be truly committed to liberty and yet reject individualism and engaging in racial collectivism. I certainly think the two things shouldn't mix, because, I mean, I'm both an individualist and a libertarian, and those things tend to go together. I think it makes sense that they do. I am disturbed by the embrace of racial collectivism that I see among certain libertarian and libertarian adjacent types in recent years. I think one of the downsides of having such open conversations online, which of course we should have, they shouldn't be censored by the government directly or indirectly, is you have a lot of people espousing a lot of really odious views about various groups based on race, sex, religion, anything. And unfortunately, you do see that mixed with some who are or have been libertarian, who kind of moved to this part of the right that embraces that. And it's distasteful to me personally and wrong, but I think you do see that when these things collide, the collectivism often does overtake the libertarianism. You know, I said, well, theoretically they wouldn't have to, but in practice, when you see these people, actually they will give way. I mean, it comes up often in discussions of immigration, where people who were libertarian or still purport to be libertarian will talk about, like, oh, well, we don't want this group or that group because of things they ascribe to them, where there you see their collectivist views overtake their libertarian views, which should require them to treat each person as an individual in all respects, including the question of, are you allowed to be in the country, or should we remove you violently?
Yeah. Well, so maybe we can kind of switch now to talk about the one method to advance liberty that you were definitely optimistic about in your speech. And you borrowed here from Albert J. Knox's remnant idea that I mentioned earlier. There's an excerpt from one of his books that often floats around with the title Isaiah's Job, which, you know, obviously that might perk up some of the ears of our Christian listeners. And so what's Knox's idea of the remnant in the context of libertarianism?
So Knox's idea in Isaiah's Job is that if you are a libertarian, I don't think he uses the word libertarian, but if you have these ideas about individual liberty that we have, you should not make it your purpose to go convert the masses to your view, as people with political ideas typically try to do. Instead, Knox's view is that you should work on the one unit of society that you actually can change, which is yourself. And you should seek to improve yourself in all ways, including in your knowledge and understanding of these of things. And if you do that, Knox says, then you will draw what he calls the remnant to you. And the idea of the remnant is that there are people scattered throughout our country and the world who think differently from others. You know, the masses of people, the people sometimes derisively referred to as NPCs, don't really think for themselves on important questions about philosophy and that sort of thing. The mass of people kind of just goes along with whatever society says they should do at the time. The goal for them is to just fit in and get along with others and do as well as they can that way. That's their idea of sort of figuring out how to act. Whereas there are others among us who think about things more for ourselves and are willing to question the received wisdom and kind of go back to square one to figure things out ourselves rather than just adopt what we were told by somebody else. And so, and those kinds of people they might not know libertarian ideas. They might never have heard of it, but maybe they perceive that something isn't right about the status quo, and they're perhaps like thirsty for real knowledge and real understanding, and they try to think it through themselves, but they're limited in their capacity to do this just based on limited information, say. Of course, in Knox's time, the information was much more limited. You only had whatever books were in your library, your bookstore, whatever, whereas now everybody can access every kind of idea. But even so, the point is, the remnant are out there, and if you improve yourself and stand out as someone who is knowledgeable and wise and a good person all around, that is going to tend to draw people to you, and then they will want to know what you think about things, and then you can share your ideas with them, and they will be receptive because they asked you, they wanted to know what you think. Whereas if you go out there and just blast your message to the masses and tell everybody, hey, I'm right about everything, you should be like me, you're going to turn off everybody, including the remnant, who don't want to be told, you know, be like me, because that's what all the other political people say to them. So that's the general idea of Isaiah's Job, and I think it's right. The one thing we all can do is, well, we can increase the number of good libertarians by one, by being one, and then we can improve ourselves. And then people will be drawn to us and want to hear from us. And in that way, ideas will spread among the remnant. And then once there's a crisis, say, in society where the world needs some ideas to rebuild upon, those ideas will be out there and available. And, we don't know.
Like they were in Argentina.
It's kind of like that, right? Things get so bad that. Okay, well, this obviously isn't working. There must be something else we can do. This guy has something that's totally different. I guess we might as well try that. Now, I don't know that Javier Milei's personal manner and approach is quite the Nockian ideal. And of course, he's a bombastic politician. But even so, right, in Latin America, libertarian ideas, the ideas of Austrian economics, are actually very widespread, right? They're taught in the Francisco Marroquin University in Guatemala. There's people all over South America who study Austrian economics, people in universities. And so the ideas are kind of there below the surface because people studied it and people shared it. And then a politician came along and up and ran with them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I wonder if Christians in particular as a group might be, better prepared to internalize your argument that it's worthwhile to, advocate for liberty, even if we don't, even if we probably won't get to live in a libertarian society in our lifetime, because, after all, we're inclined to keep following Jesus, even though Jesus probably won't come back and remake the world in our lifetime either. But you do give, I think, some, practical examples. And I think this is, like you said, kind of where one of these areas where we can really kind of make the world more libertarian is by focusing on ourselves and looking for opportunities to be more free ourselves. And there are some things that have happened kind of accidentally, sometimes through, wins in the court or whatever. But, since you gave that lecture, the homeschool movement was accidentally supercharged by COVID policy. And, did things like that, that have happened in the last, few years, made you kind of more optimistic about the power of the remnant approach? And are there other examples like that kind of expansion of the homeschool movement, or even this school choice movement, which has also had, a lot of wins since then? Are there examples like that that you would say, here's some things that we can look at and see that the remnant idea is kind of beginning, we can see that it's producing some fruit?
Yeah, well, the COVID homeschooling is a good example. And, a lot of people look upon the COVID experience and it makes them, it gives them only feelings of doom and gloom, quite understandably, as they saw almost all of their country just accept tyranny for a while in all aspects of their lives. And that's very disturbing, but it's also very heartening the way we saw people respond to that by doing things like homeschooling. And of course, the groundwork for them was already laid by people who were already doing homeschooling. The ideas of homeschooling, the curricula and all that sort of thing were out there because of those people who said, even before COVID, I don't want the government to be educating my children. I want to take control of this part of my family's life, and took it upon themselves to do that. And then when they were kind of forced into it, that model was available for other people to pick up and innovate on and so forth. And I think that also the whole COVID experience awakened a lot of people who sort of cared about rights in the back of their mind as important, and made them realize that, no, they're actually really important. And it's important that I object to the government violating my rights. They were complacent and comfortable, but now it's given a lot of people a greater appreciation for liberty and preserving their liberty, and has prompted them to become libertarians or more libertarian in studying these ideas. So it's been very beneficial in that way too. Otherwise, things you could do to increase your own liberty could include things like moving to a place that has more liberty, or where the government will leave you alone, whether that's another country that has more liberty of the sort that's important to you, or moving out into the wilderness where nobody's going to pay attention to what you're doing. You can increase your own liberty in those ways. And of course, you can find legal ways to pay less in taxes and be in jurisdictions that will regulate you less. If you want to start a business, figure out where, what's going to be the least hostile to you. There are lots of practical ways to increase your own liberty, even if the liberty in general is not going to be increased for everybody else, if it's important enough to you. But of course, there are always trade-offs to that. I moved from Illinois to Texas in part because it was a freer state. I did it during the middle of COVID and could see very starkly the difference there. But is Texas unfree in some way that Illinois, some ways that Illinois is freer? Well, yes, it is in some ways. And are there other states that offer even greater freedom? Arguably, yes, there are. But of course, the government isn't everything, and there are other factors that decide that affect where you want to live. So each person, of course, has to decide how important particular liberties are to them and decide what price they're willing to pay to have them. And as a practical matter, that's always going to be the case. I think we can safely say for our lifetimes, pretty much everywhere on Earth is going to be under the jurisdiction of some states as we know it. And so your option is not to go live without the state, but live where you think you can thrive best and enjoy the liberties that are most important to you.
Yeah, well, you know, there's sometimes I think this mistaken idea that like you can't have joy, you can't thrive at all, you can't have any happiness in your life as long as the state exists. And, well, and I think sometimes there's this, I think, libertarian tendency to kind of think in those terms. And, you know, we kind of forget that liberty is about being able to have the freedom to pursue the things that matter the most to you. And so sometimes we are forced to make trade-offs. We sort of say, well, you know, if I live here, I may lose some liberty in this regard, but I also get to, you know, live close to my parents or, whatever it is, work in a job that I love. And so it's about sort of increasing your joy. So, you know, our friends at the Cato Institute did some, they have this kind of freedom index that they do. And I was looking at it not that long ago, and I noticed that, you know, Switzerland as a country ranks highest on the freedom index for them. But Switzerland also has expensive tariffs. And one of the ways that people in Switzerland deal with that, especially if they're close to the border, is they hop the border and they go to another country and they buy their groceries there. And, you know, I have a friend who chose to live in Dubai because he valued the economic and relative religious freedom he has there. But others, for example, so even if my friend was gay, he probably wouldn't want to live in Dubai, right? And not that Dubai is necessarily the worst country to live for gay people, but it is a country that, you know, you can't live openly if that's what you want to do. And if that were the case, those trade-offs for moving to Dubai would not have been worth it for him, right? And so it does seem that sometimes maximizing freedom is just basically about picking the statist option that works the best for you, because there's not really that many non-statist options. And so, yeah, it's interesting to think in that way, that it's not necessarily, because I think libertarians can be sort of moral absolutists, and there's good reasons to be that way. But I think there's also room for pragmatism in thinking about what it means to manage with a situation that's not ideal, so that you are able to get the most joy and find the most freedom for yourself. There's something else Cato has done that's really interesting, which is their Human Progress Project. And what they've done there is they've noted how liberty has kind of quietly been making the world a better place over time. And so they talk about things like extreme poverty and how these, you know, rates of all these indicators have just sort of shifted so rapidly in the last couple hundred years and in the last even few decades now. And I mean, does that give you some hope? Because it seems to me that, you know, the one thing that's frustrating about that is how little people notice. That we still kind of live amongst people who feel like the world is worse than it's ever been, but almost every important indicator suggests it's better than it's ever been. but I mean, do you think that, you know, that this sort of quiet revolution in economic freedom that has led to so much prosperity and I mean, does that give you some hope as well about where we might be going?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes me feel good about the world right now. And you have seen that in so many countries that have liberalized relative to the past and seen their people's standard of living or their poverty rates go up because they adopted something closer to free market policies. Doesn't mean they're anywhere near perfect or what we would want, but that definitely has improved the lives of countless people across the globe. And, you know, Americans, they're a little too negative about liberty in America as well. And on the one hand, that's kind of an odd thing to say because we have a federal government that takes so much of our money, that oppresses us through so many laws and regulations and so on. And it's definitely something that doesn't come to mind when you're looking about what the Federal Reserve is doing to our money and thinking about what the consequences of that will be, or when you see us getting in new wars. Things look pretty bleak if you're looking at those particular things. On the other hand, liberty has increased in lots of ways in over the course of American history as a whole, and even in relatively recent history. You know, an obvious one is, you know, I mean, from the 19th century to the 20th century, there's a really obvious one that we had slavery and then a great oppression of a substantial portion of the population that we don't have anymore. That's something libertarians definitely should celebrate. We do have wars now, and they're really terrible, in particularly in what they inflict on innocent people in other countries. On the other hand, we haven't had anything like on the scale of, say, World War I, where not only did you have mass slaughter abroad, you had like the country mobilizing behind it, people just like being fine with their sons and daughters being sent off to it. Wars are met with a lot more resistance now than they used to be, and they don't do it on the same scale that they used to. There could be a variety of reasons for that. And you don't have conscription anymore, which is huge. So although a lot of the foreign policy stuff is really bad and it could get a lot worse, it's been bad in the past, and it's in some ways it's not as bad now as it was then. And or if you think about, as I do, freedom of speech, the First Amendment didn't do much for most of our country's history. You know, like in World War I, they just shut down the speech of anybody who dissented at all. You couldn't do anything about it. Well, now, again, the courts aren't as perfect as we'd like, but you couldn't do that now. Everybody knows that the First Amendment stops you from shutting down, from imprisoning people for speaking critically of a war. Nobody would accept that happening now, I hope. Or when films first became a thing, well, first, the courts just assumed, well, of course, the Constitution doesn't protect that. You can censor films all you want. And then gradually over time, that eroded. And now you can have anything in a film that you want. So the trend in so many things has actually gotten better. Or Second Amendment rights, too, right? I mean, again, it was assumed for a long time that the Second Amendment doesn't really do much. It talks about a militia. And that was not a serious protection of people's right to keep and bear arms until very recently. And, what else? There are so many other things. I mean, well, so shortly before I gave that speech at the Mises Circle in 2011, I wrote a book called Libertarianism Today, where I reviewed a lot of issues from a libertarian perspective. And one of them was the war on drugs, which has been a favorite libertarian topic. And at that time, I think I said that I expected that polls would have, perhaps, have half of Americans supporting marijuana legalization in 10 years. Well, marijuana legalization happened way faster than that all over the place. It wasn't just polls. It just happened everywhere. And even in states where I live in Texas, where it's nominally illegal, it's basically legal because you can buy a essentially identical product at any store that has a form of THC the federal government hadn't got around to yet, although I guess they've just banned that. But the trend on so many things actually has been in favor of more liberty. Homeschooling as well, right? Homeschooling and school choice. So there's pros and cons to school choice, of course, because you have government taking money from some people and giving it to others. But it removes one element of coercion through government education and letting people choose where they want to go instead of forcing them to go to a particular place. That is another step in the right direction that breaks down the government monopoly on education and creates a sort of new constituency of people who have the expectation now that, of course, I get to decide where my child goes to school or homeschool them myself or do whatever I want. So there are many, many positive trends, even with all the bad stuff going on.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time. And I think we've been talking for, we've been talking for about an hour. You mentioned a book that you wrote about 15 years ago, Libertarianism Today. Where are some other places that people could find you? Are there other things that you've worked on that I could link in the show notes to people can check out?
Well, if you want to buy Libertarianism Today, I think the best place to do that is through the Mises Institute. They have a paperback edition that you can't get anywhere else. It's a lot cheaper than you can get it anywhere else. So go there and buy that if you'd like to. And although it says Libertarianism Today and it was published in 2010, it's still pretty good right now. I think people who want an introduction to libertarianism across a wide range of topics could still learn a lot from that. And otherwise, I don't have any one place to tell you to look. You can look me up on Twitter, where I'm Jacob Hubert. And if you want to know what my employer is doing, although I'm not speaking for them today, you can go to their website at nclalegal.org and see everything we're doing to fight against the administrative state.
Awesome. I'll include all of those links. And I want to thank you again for making time to talk with us. This was one I was looking forward to. And I'm glad that you made time. It's a great presentation. Also, make sure I link that, the original 2011 presentation, because there's a lot of great material in there. And but it was, I was just everything you said, I thought, well, a little bit of time's passed. I wonder what he thinks about that now. So I was glad that you're willing to make some time to talk to me about it.
Well, glad to have an opportunity to give an update.
Thanks, Jacob, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.